Welcome to episode 66 of Meenal's World. Thank you all for joining me again this week, and a big thank you to everyone who's messaged me on Twitter and Instagram about my episode last week. It was a very teary one, but also one full of so much hope. So I know these episodes make you cry sometimes, but I also make sure that you finish these shows with a big, big smile on your face. And this week I spoke to Patsy Stevenson. Now, a lot of you may remember her because her photo was plastered all across the internet and on national newspapers. Now, she was detained at the Clapham Common Vigil for Sarah Everard. Now, you may remember the case of Sarah Everard here in the UK. She was killed by a policeman. And throughout the last couple of years, we've seen a lot of truths come up to the surface about the Met Police, especially around misogyny. Now, with Patsy, I discussed violence against women. I discussed the personal cost that all of this came with, because after she went viral online, her life changed forever. We also discussed her new passion for activism and everything she wants to do with her platform that she's built. So without further ado, here's Patsy Stevenson. Welcome to the show, Patsy. It's so lovely to have an hour to speak to you and learn more about your life, well, after everything that's happened. So thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for asking me.
Patsy, I saw your photo on national news, on newspapers, and it just seemed like overnight your life had changed. And I kind of know what that's like, because that happened to me 2 years ago as well when I protested. And I almost feel like when you go out and you speak up, when you speak truth to power, you know, life changes within a few hours, literally overnight, and there's nothing to prepare you for that. What was it like for you when you went out to the vigil and the next day your life had changed? Just talk me through that time.
I mean, even thinking about it, it's like I can feel myself well up a little bit, because it feels like it didn't happen. It feels like it's unreal or something. But I remember, you know, went to the vigil, just, you know, I wanted to put a candle down, and everyone was mourning for Sarah. And it really was a weird experience that straight after that all happened. You know, obviously I saw the cameras take a lot of pictures, but I thought, you know, they're taking pictures of everyone, this is just what happens. And then later on, as I'm walking down the street, a group of people wanted an interview with me. So I did a quick interview, like on a phone. It was like nothing serious. And then everyone started saying, you're that girl on the front page. And I was like, the front page of what? They're like, you're everywhere. And I was like, what do you mean? So we searched like a few bits and pieces, and someone had leaked my name and where I was from and things like that. So I had no hold over it. I couldn't stay anonymous. But it went viral. And, you know, seeing my face on the front page of everything with my name as well was just, I think I went into shock a little bit. And I didn't know what was happening. And then people, again, walking home, like people were trying to take selfies with me and stuff. And I thought, this is so strange. Like, you know, I didn't know how to cope with it at all. But when I got home, I think I was trying to get onto Twitter, because I had a Twitter account that was for like science stuff, physics stuff. And I couldn't log in. I couldn't remember the password. So I made a new one, and then saw like Nigella Lawson was tweeting my picture, like everyone, like celebrities and everyone. And I immediately got like 100,000 followers. And I thought, what is happening? This is like crazy. I couldn't sleep. I've never felt that level of anxiety before. And I'm already an anxious person. You know, I have mental health issues, but that was intense. And I remember the one main thing that sticks with me is that my friend Lily said that she'd watch the Twitter for an hour, just so I could sleep for an hour, and had an hour's sleep, and then woke up exactly an hour on the dot and was like right back to it. And there was a FaceTime with, you know, some random people that wanted me to do like this protest thing, and that people were trying to like puppeteer me a bit as well. So it was a bit awkward, because I wasn't an activist before that. I'd never been to a protest before. I didn't understand what was happening. I didn't know what Kill the Bill was. I didn't know anything. So immediately I had my whole inbox filled with media requests from all around the world, from like New York Times, CNN, NBC, from Italy, from Greece, from New Zealand, all sorts of places. And I was just overwhelmed. There were like thousands of requests. I remember taking a shower as well and leaving my phone for like 5 minutes whilst I had a shower, and coming out and my whole phone was just missed calls and voicemails. I thought, this is just, is this my life now? Like what happens from this? And quite a few people were saying, you know, oh, it'll die down, you know, you'll only get this for now, but it will stop. And it didn't really. So as well, a lot of people said that I was like a white feminist and that all of these different things. And I thought, you know, I know that I could sort of be like, well, I'm not. But I thought if I just show people that that's just not who I am as a person, and sort of utilize this platform to push other people up, because I then met so many people through protests that I then went to afterwards. And all these people were so lovely. But these women had been working tirelessly for years to get that message across. And then here I was with no prior experience being shot to the limelight. And I thought, of course, it's because of the way I look as well. And that's a major factor. And it's because I'm palatable for the media in this weird society accepts me but no one else way, that, you know, it really did anger me. And it's quite upsetting, and upsetting as well, because when I did them first interviews, I didn't realize what was going on. I said, oh, we need to get the conversation away from police, when actually they are part of the problem. And I didn't know that at that point. And a lot of other groups were like, why did you say that? You've then pushed us back a few steps. And, you know, I'd say sorry about that at protest now, but if I can use my platform for good, that's, you know, I'm going to do it. And that's what I've been doing for the entire year now. So,
yeah, it's been just over a year, hasn't it, Patsy?
Mm. Yeah, it was March the 13th, I think.
I remember when, you know, something similar happened to me as well, where, so it's a different, only difference was, I'd say, Patsy's, I was pregnant at that time when I protested. And the next morning, on the Monday morning, I was getting these requests. And I remember it was like 3 p.m. and I still hadn't had breakfast. And usually that's okay, but because I was pregnant, I was like, I need to eat, you know, I had to feed a baby as well. But at that time, I couldn't really comprehend what was happening. It was almost like I was just running on adrenaline. And just like you, my husband did have to take my phone from me and say, look, I'll deal with your Twitter and just take a bit break, go for a walk, and just try and reset, because you're just running on adrenaline. You feel like you have to answer to everybody, because some part of you thinks, I can't just let this die down, because now I have a voice and I have to just, you know, amplify it everywhere as much as I can. Could you see at that time, 1 year ago, could you see what impact that would have on your life at a personal level 1 year on?
No way. I think I couldn't have predicted this at all. I think, you know, I think as well, because of a lot of people saying it will die down, I just assumed it would die down eventually. But I think from the amount of things, I'm very much a person that if there's something you can help with, you should. I think it's a human, you know, thing to just help people. And, you know, I've been through a lot in my life where I feel like I can empathize a lot with quite a few people. And so using that and thinking, okay, if you have a platform, the amount of good you can do with a platform is just absolutely extraordinary. And knowing now that people come to me, and like, I've just got off an interview, like a meeting with someone who wants my help pushing something that is going to do so much good for women. And that is just like extraordinary to think that I've actually been able to make a small difference. And it baffles me sometimes, though, that sometimes I get approached and people say that they like fangirl over me, and they're like, oh my God, I'm starstruck by you. And it really, like, it doesn't click in my head. I'm like, I don't know what to say to that, because I feel like I'm just a common person. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't feel like anything special or anything. And I think when it's laid out, you know, so many people are thanking me and praising me for the things that I've done, but I think many people are doing these things. It's just that because I'm spoken about in the public eye, that I get recognition for these things. And really, I just want to use my platform for recognition of other people as well, because everyone, it's like the feminist beach, I call it, where everyone is a grain of sand. There's no bigger, there's no smaller. It's everyone is putting in the effort and everyone is on this beach together. And one day, hopefully, that beach will be perfect for our, you know, grandkids or people to come, and hopefully we'll have equality. So,
were you aware of systemic injustices happening in this country before all of this had happened? Or were you quite happy with how the country was running? Because for me personally, I wouldn't say I was happy with how everything was run. I knew like racism was sort of a cloud hanging over us. I knew there were lots of injustices to brown women, pregnant women as well. We were discriminated against in lots of areas of society. But I think it only hit home for me when I protested, because I realized that actually now it's affecting me on a personal level. What was it like for you before the vigil? Did you feel like things were sort of okay and you were just happy to just get on with life? Or did you feel like things had to change?
I think, you know, because I'm white, I experienced life a lot differently from a lot of other people. And I've never been in trouble with the police. I've never had that. I've never been like profiled or anything like that. So my only interactions with the police, for example, would be just, oh, I'm reporting something, something's gone on, this has happened. And it'd only be minor things, but, you know, like I'd hear a domestic or something. But yeah, like before that, I was very much into sort of women in STEM because I'm a physicist, and I was in all the women in STEM groups, and very much I was like an activist, I guess, in some sort, because I was trying to fight for more women to be heard in physics and STEM subjects. And like I said, I'm part of them groups at uni. But it's strange going from that and also thinking, you know, I knew about feminism, but I didn't know how other women had experienced feminism or experienced misogyny and sexism. And I think I am so, so appreciative of the women that I've met at these protests that I've been to now, who have really opened up my eyes and given me the information that they really didn't have to give me. It's completely like, you know, emotional labor on their part that they really didn't have to do. And I've tried to be as open and as forthcoming with it, like trying to get my own information about things and learn on my own. But, you know, I was very, I think from the background that I was from and sort of my upbringing and I'd never really taken into account what other people were going through. I think it's a very like ignorant, self-centered view that I had. And I think you should always work on it. And I'm still obviously always working on it now. And I don't think there's an end point where you're like, oh, you know, I'm not racist now, or I'm not, you know, and it doesn't happen. Even internalized misogyny, you know, we all have it because of the way society is. But I think I'm really glad almost, because I was in such a bubble of just like ignorance and white privilege and really didn't understand at all and almost didn't want to understand, because again, it was kind of like, well, it doesn't affect me. So, you know, what's the point? And I hate that I used to think like that. You know, I've got three young cousins and they are my absolute world. Like I'm like tearing up thinking about like, because they're black, and I know that when they come into the world and they start doing, you know, I know that they've already been racially abused in school, and it's, you know, it obviously it's emotional, but I can't imagine what they're going through. And to think that, you know, two of them are young girls and they're going to grow up not only facing the struggles that women do, but also that they're black, and also they might be queer, they might be, you know, we don't know. And to think that they've got so much to deal with, and that I was so closed off and not understanding that, and that there are people out there who are, you know, they call themselves feminists, but they're not looking at the bigger picture, they're not listening to other women. And you know, I think it's really, really important now, like really, really important. You know, feminism is becoming a bit more of a movement now, and you know, people are taking on, it's like another stage in feminism almost. And I think I'm grateful for the people that have taught me things and given me books and, you know, and really opened up my eyes to this stuff, because now I understand a bit more about the injustices that are going on, and hope that I can, you know, just amplify voices and really work with people. And, you know, and I tried to do this with like opportunities as well. It didn't click with me until I was told by someone at my uni, actually, fantastic woman. She said, you know, why don't you give your opportunities to other people who don't get those opportunities? And I thought that never clicked in my brain, because it wouldn't have. And now it's like, you know, I've had opportunities like on a media channel a big media channel for being on a panel to speak about police brutality. I thought, well, I've only experienced it once, where I have a friend who's black and trans, and she's experienced it loads, you know, and perfect person to speak about it, loads of information would be, you know, and I said that to the media company and they said, oh, trans, oh no. And it's, you know, like, what is going on? So it's a way of like, I'm understanding now how much the media, you know, they very much are like, oh, we'll put a token black person on this, or a token queer person, token trans person. And really sometimes those people don't express the views of that whole group. And, you know, and it's very like targeted, and they know what they're doing. And I hope one day that, you know, we are actually equal, and it's going to take so much time, but I am glad that, you know, that I've been to these protests now and I've spoken to these women, and I'm absolutely like best friends with some of these amazing women, and they are to thank for most of what I do now, I would say, you know.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about feminism and, you know, International Women's Day and all of these big days where we celebrate activists and campaigners, I do think from a personal point of view, I do think we're just a tiny dot in a big picture. I mean, our mothers, our grandmothers, all the feminists before us, they're actually the ones who put in all the hard work. They've paved the way for us. And I think it's really important to remember that when we look at the feminist movement now, we can't forget the people who've paved the way for us to be able to do all of this. Just going back to what you were saying about, you know, giving your spots on media channels to other women or trans people who you think could speak better than you, who have a better voice. What do you think about the idea that there's only enough space for some people to be activists or campaigners, because if not, it gets too saturated. There are only a few spots for people to stand out. And then you have people like myself, brown women, South Asian women, ethnic minority groups, who are trying to create our own space. But then at the same time, that space is so small that there's not enough oxygen to feed us, or almost like sort of starved of oxygen in that tiny bubble. How do you think that we can, apart from obviously giving your spot to other people, how else do you think that we can create a space where there's no limit? You know, there are no boundaries, there are no walls to keep us enclosed in that tiny box.
I think one of the main things that a lot of people should know when they say things like, oh, we're fighting the patriarchy, is that, you know, that the patriarchy is not just, okay, the patriarchy. It comes with other things as well. It's under this umbrella of capitalism. But, you know, under that is racism, patriarchy. You know, you've got all these different things. But racism is alongside, you know, and we shouldn't just, when we're dealing with the patriarchy and when we're dealing with feminism and things like that, it shouldn't just be, oh, here's one space and there's enough for certain amount of women. It should be that these women's voices are just as important, if not more sometimes, you know, because they experience so many other things that are under this umbrella. And if you're just using this space of like, oh, there's a group of women, large group of women, oh, we're all fighting for like freedom and equal rights, you will not get equality if you are not making that space big enough for all women. It just doesn't it's not going to happen. So I don't understand why a lot of hugely, you know, middle-aged white women of a certain class and they don't understand. I think, you know, they're very ignorant to it, and it's a whole, you know, power game as well, which is very strange. But, you know, I think just amplifying voice, if you've got a platform, you need to be amplifying other people's voices, and also not getting in the way of them conversations. Because a lot of times people have asked me certain questions. They say, you know, what do you think about, you know, feminism in the black community? I'm like, why are you asking me? That's not, you know, I can say bits and pieces, but it's not my conversation. So it's very odd where, you know, this is their conversation. It's nothing to do with me. And even at protests as well, I've been to some like trans protests or protests of Black Lives Matter, all sorts of different things. And it's not actually Black Lives Matter, but a few other little protest things like that. And people have asked me for an interview or me to speak. And it's like, I'm just here for support. And it's strange to think that people, they want something. It's like a token. Oh, because of who you are, you'll get this and you'll get that. And it's like, but I don't have knowledge of that thing. I cannot have a full conversation on and debate about, you know, Black Lives Matter because I'm not black. That doesn't make any sense. And a lot of times, I think that did strike me when I was on Twitter, and I was very vocal about trans rights. And then, you know, someone did say to me, but, you know, you make sure you don't get into this space, because although it's okay for me to say certain things, but it is not my right at all to be able to debate those topics, because I don't have enough information. I can't possibly understand where those people are coming from. So it's not fair for me to, it's almost like putting other topics into debate that they might not want to debate, or that isn't a debate, or that's offensive. But yeah, I think a lot of times, I think if you just, you know, you need to understand, and people, especially white people, I wish that white women would just listen and just open this.
And I do think it's down to personal responsibility now, Patsy, because I do feel like a lot of people talk about, oh, we want to give these people opportunity, we want to give them the space. And I understand that there's a collective good in that. And there is that, you know, that want to create enough space for everybody. But just like you mentioned, and that's a very good point, Patsy, and I think that's something for me to reflect on as well, that sometimes you want to be part of every conversation because you feel like you have to speak up, but it comes down to personal responsibility to say, okay, I'm just going to take a step back, let the people who've lived those experiences speak, and I'm going to listen to them. And I don't think we have enough of that, especially in the social media age where everything is so saturated. Everybody has an opinion on everything. Everybody wants to share everything about everybody. And I was at a panel the other day and someone mentioned something quite profound. And that was, you know, anti-racism is doing act. It's a verb. It's not just something you say. It's not something you post on social media. You have to actually do something. And if that means taking a step back, that's something as well. And I think that we think that creating change is all about being loud and going into these protests. Actually, sometimes it's just taking a step back and letting people speak.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the same with like what I learned as being a trans ally, you know, that was my first sort of learning how to be an ally properly. And like I've said before, I've never called myself an ally outright, but it's a doing word, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? And that's the same for everything that you believe in. And I think very much like I was working on possibly doing a podcast of my own, but the main reason for that would have been literally so that people would come and go, oh, we'll listen to Patsy, and all I'm going to do is pass the mic to someone else. And that's the whole point. It's like, I'm passing the mic because I know that in the media, and so many people know that in the media, you know, they'll get someone on, they'll get like a black or brown woman on, and they'll talk a little bit, but they'll twist it to their own narrative. And then they won't listen to them. They won't listen to the points, or they'll jab at them or say something that doesn't make any sense. And they'll make them look silly on TV. And then yet again, we've got an expression of racism. And, you know, what needs to be done is that I would love to have a space where, yeah, people are on my platform. People want to hear me. And people are like, oh, yeah, Patsy. But then when they come to this space, it's actually, oh, I know that you've come here for me. What we should be doing is listening to this person. This person has a whole barrage of experience and knowledge, and they know what they're talking about, and we need to listen to them. Just sit there. I'm just going to listen. I might ask a few questions about like, oh, so what does that do? Da, 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 or, you know, but it will never be a question of something that I can't find out with my own, you know, looking it on. It's Google. Do you know what I mean? You can look stuff up. And at the end, you know, I would love to have something where it's like, okay, here's a book as well that I, because I'm an avid reader, I want to push authors that don't get pushed. A lot of black and brown women don't get any recognition as authors, which is ridiculous. And queer women as well. And so, you know, books, that's fantastic. And then put a petition at the end. So if you want to help, here you can, here's a petition. You know, especially struck me when, you know, the issues in Afghanistan arose. And, you know, no one was talking about the Afghanistani women who were at the forefront of fighting, you know, and it's just like these people don't get spoken about. And when they do, it's all from a narrative of white people yet again. And then you've got a whole group of white people on a panel on a TV show talking about, oh, well, what can we do? Da-da-da. What have they been doing? And it's, where are the people that are actually doing it, who are actually experiencing it? And I'm really grateful as well, because Penguin Books especially, they send me books now, which is so lovely because I love reading. And a lot of the ones that send me are to do with feminism from Black and Brown perspectives, and, you know, and queer perspectives and trans perspectives. And I, before that, I'd only read Florence Given's Women Don't Know You Pretty. And it's all right, but it's, you know, it doesn't, it's a very small perspective on a very large topic. And, you know, now I'm into Audre Lorde, and I'm reading a book called Hood Feminism as well. And these books are so informative. And I think that's the main point, is that people need to open up their perspectives, realize that the world doesn't revolve around them. I think a lot of white women do have that view, and I think it's sort of ingrained in there, and they need to just, oh, okay, it doesn't. What is actually going on? And realize that, oh yeah, no, something racist is going on, but you don't have to be so loud about it and stand up for this person. You're not a white knight. It's like a white savior complex. Do you know what I mean? And it does my head in.
Well, Patsy, you seem to be very active in creating these spaces for more, for the minority groups and ethnic minority groups, and those from the LGBTQ community as well. Was there a specific instance that gave you this realization that, hold on, these people are not getting the platform they deserve? Was it something you saw, something you read?
I think it was the moment when I said, well, I have a friend who's Black and trans, and can you speak to them? And they said no. And I really questioned it. I thought, but what, like, what's the reasoning? And they did say, they danced around the idea of, oh, but you're a public figure, you're in the public eye, all this rubbish. And I thought, well, I met someone called Chantelle Lunt, fantastic activist. And she is an ex-police officer, and she's a Black woman who has experienced so much in the police force, and that's why she came out of it. And she's the co-founder of Merseyside BLM. And she's just fantastic. And she's only got like 3,000 followers or something. And it was like, wait, what? And I looked at all these different people and I thought, these are people that I'm like, I'm starstruck by. They are so inspirational, so knowledgeable. They're just the best people. They're so empathetic and caring. And they just don't, like, it's like people just don't want to know. And I really looked into why that was, and, you know, looked into, there's the whole, even when people are, women are being murdered, and you look at, you know, Sarah Everard now, it's not her fault entirely. There is absolutely no, you know, blame on anything to do with the family or her. But when it goes into the media, it is very sped up and talked about massively and very promoted. But when a Black woman is murdered, it's a very different narrative and it's a very different story, and it oftentimes doesn't get a lot of coverage. I also was told, you know, to think about if I were any other ethnicity and got arrested at the vigil, how would the headlines read? Would I have got the platform? Do you know what I mean? So really, it's, you've got to sort of, you know, there was no one moment, but I think over the time, it's just like, oh God, this is really happening, isn't it?
And yeah. As I remember reading an article by Sabina Nessa's family, and they said, look, if we were a white family, so much more would have been done for, you know, to find the justice for Sabina. And that really struck a chord with me as well, Patsy, because I feel like when I protested, yes, there was lots of positive energy, people supporting me, people really understood what I was doing. But then there was a little space that was taken up where people were, you know, shouting the usual racist and sexist stuff to me on Twitter. And that space could have been filled up with more, you know, affirmations and encouragement, but it wasn't. And like, that was really not necessary. And one of the reasons I protested, Patsy, at that time was, as I said, I was very naive to the world around me, especially in this country. I just went out of pure anger. I said, look, this is really affecting me. I have to channel this energy somehow. I'm just going to go out and just see what happens. And I did. What took you to the vigil that day?
Well, for me, like, I never watched the news. I do now, obviously, because I'm usually on it. But I never did watch the news. And I was very much just introvert, sort of, you know, reading my books. That was it, just a physics student. And then I... Basically, my uncle was taken into hospital, and he lives in Brighton, and he was without a home. So he was living in a hostel at the time. And I went to Brighton to look after him, but he was unconscious as soon as he was taken into hospital. And they said, like, you know, it's looking like he's going to pass away. So I looked after him whilst my family weren't there, like they couldn't turn up in time and things like that. But over the days, you know, they turned up here and there and looked after him. But I wanted to remain there as much as I could because I was very close to my uncle. It came to a point where we had to sort of clear his things from his room. And I found in amongst his stuff, he had a badge of women's rights and a badge for pronouns as well. And I thought, you know, of course. And my uncle was the type of person where he didn't have anything, you know, but he would care for people a lot. And he would, you know, I'd like to think that I have that sort of mindset of like, even if I don't have anything, I would give to others, you know, and really try and help other people. And a lot of people say like, you know, oh, you trace it back to a man, or you did this because of a man. It doesn't really matter like who it is, but it, you know, it sparked something in me. And I was very close to my uncle and he stood up for women's rights. And when he passed away, you know, obviously I was very grief stricken. And it hit me very hard. But then I remember just being at home after it happened and just sort of flicking on TV, and he passed away on the 5th of March. So this was very close to the vigil. And I remember just watching TV and scrolling through Instagram, things like that. And then I saw about Sarah and I thought, how horrible that like I'm going through this grief, but I knew where he was and I knew he was in a bed. Do you know what I mean? And I just think, I can't imagine what they're going through, not knowing things. And, you know, it was just really awful to even imagine what they were going through. And then to think, like, we saw that it had been cancelled and the police were like, oh, you know, you can't go out. And I just thought, how dare they tell women that they can't go and mourn for someone that's been murdered when it's such an injustice? Do you know what I mean? Like, it just didn't make any sense. So, you know, that was a huge part of it for me. Also, a lot of the time in my life, I've always been in relationships, and I wish I hadn't, but I had. And every time I would want to stick up for someone or, you know, change something. And whoever I was with would say, like, oh, pipe down, shh, don't make a scene, you know, don't get involved. And I wish I had, because the one time I was single, actually, I did do something and now I'm able to change so much. So actually, you know, I think a lot of the time if you're told just to shh, don't listen, don't you know what I mean? Just do what you want to do, you know. But yeah.
Wow. That's really powerful, Patsy. Yeah, I think that a lot of women that day felt the same. I don't think anybody felt any different, to be honest. It was a mixture of anger, sadness and, you know, that question, like, why did this happen? Why did it have to happen? And I can't imagine the grief Sarah's family went through. I mean, you got Sarah, you got Sabina, Nessa. So many families have been through this grief, which is totally unnecessary. And what adds insult to injury is that there's no accountability for the Met Police. There's nobody saying that you guys have to be held accountable. You guys are wrong. I mean, look at right now, look at Boris Johnson, all these parties that he's held with the Conservative government, the fine is £50. That's like a glass of wine for them. It's nothing. It's pennies for them. So this is, for me, that's not accountability. That's not punishing. That's just, you know, hiding things under the rug, which we've been seeing for the last God knows how many years. When the Met Police got to you and said, look, you know, when they got to you and they cuffed you down, was it like an immediate physical attack on you? Or did they give you any warning? Or, I mean, what actually happened at that moment?
So, I mean, because I'm taking them through legal proceedings at the moment, I can't explain exactly what happened, but hopefully the fact that I'm taking them through legal proceedings kind of speaks for itself, that I know what happened, they know what happened. We have a lot of things, you know, that say what happened. And hopefully when that comes to light, I will be able to tell the full story of what happened at that vigil. And I tell you now, I've never experienced anything like that in my entire life. And that also made me realize that a lot of, before that happened, my view on like protesters, activists, things like that, I thought, you know, oh, they're all crazy. They all need to calm down. You know, this is ridiculous. And now I'm annoyed at my past self for not joining in sooner and being like, these people are fighting for human rights every single day and not even getting an ounce of media coverage most of the time, you know?
What are you taking them to court for? Is that public knowledge?
I don't think it's public knowledge at the moment. It will be soon, though, because our deadline is approaching, so it will happen soon. But
because I know, Patsy, from at least from what I've read and stuff, I know that on that day when that vigil happened, there were lots of issues and there were lots of cases happening at that time. And Reclaim the Streets also had their case. And I believe their case was for their right to protest and how the Met Police tried to interfere with that. I believe that was what the main sort of headline was of that case. Are there any other sort of legal proceedings happening apart from yours related to that vigil specifically?
I don't believe there are, but I think if mine went the way that we want it to, I think it could open up a lot of opportunity for others. You know, if, like, I'm even thinking at some point of crowdsourcing or crowdfunding for other people's legal fees and things like that, because the issue that we have that I didn't realize, another thing that I've been made aware of, is that for legal aid, for you to apply for legal aid, you have to have no income at all. It has to be really on the breadline. And as a student, I had no income. I have a dog though, and I have to provide for her. I've got no bursary for this year because I'm having to repeat it. So I've got absolutely nothing. So I've had to, you know, get a few sort of 0-hour contract jobs, and they're minimal jobs. They're like absolutely nothing. But that means that I can't qualify for legal aid. So with that, it's like, if you've got any sort of job, you have to fund all of your legal fees. And that's crazy. It's like, so you could be unlawfully arrested and the police have no accountability at all. Like, you, like, that's crazy. How many people are unlawfully arrested? I bet it's a lot, you know?
Hmm.
And yeah, so I'm hoping that, you know, if ours goes to and actually does what we hope it will do, hopefully, you know, we're able to open up a few more opportunities for other people to come to light with what happened to them.
Patsy, how are you covering your legal fees right now, if you don't mind me asking? Because taking the Met Police to court is expensive.
It is very expensive. So we're working out ways to do it. It could be crowdfunding. It could be no win, no fee type thing. I'm not entirely sure, but, you know, I'm hoping that it'll be almost like an investment type thing where it's like, okay, this is going to be hard, but in the end, we can help loads of other people and try and do some sort of justice and accountability, you know?
Yeah, because we were quite lucky, I think, and I say this all the time. I don't think that if I repeated what I did, I don't think it would have the same sort of impact, because we were in that vacuum of the pandemic and everybody wanted to help doctors. Everybody sort of understood what we were trying to do. So I think we raised just over 70,000. And we didn't actually take it to court because ours was a legal challenge. We sent them a letter, and it was just through letters. We were just trying to negotiate because the government said, look, we actually won't take it to the High Court. We're going to settle it outside. And I think it's because they didn't have a case to fight against us. They knew that they were wrong on so many levels. So I think if we did take it to the High Court, it would have cost us a lot more money. And to crowdfund that extra bit would have been really very difficult. But you know, the thing that saddens me the most, Patsy, is obviously, like, with the Met Police or even the government, when they're going into court or they're paying legal fees, that's through taxpayers' money. And it's like, why are we wasting taxpayers' money on something that's so obvious, so glaringly obvious?
Yeah. And it baffles me that, you know, you think, imagine, like, someone gets unlawfully arrested, some kid walking down the street, you know, and it happens literally every day. I've seen videos in my group chats at the moment. There's just video after video of, like, you know, young black male walking down the street doing absolutely nothing, gets arrested for no reason. There is absolutely no reason. And everyone knows it's no reason. And because it won't get media coverage, or there's like no one really talking about it, he can't take them to court. You know, he's a kid. He's not got any money. You know, and that as well can maybe possibly ruin his future. You know, if someone says, oh, have you ever been arrested before? It looks like a black stain on your, you know, it's ridiculous. And I don't understand how the police and the government can just get away with anything at this point. And like we've seen with Boris Johnson, you know, I know that at the vigil, so many people were fined £200, £200, not 50 quid, £200 for mourning the death of a woman rather than £50 for having a party. you know, it's a bit different. And also, these people were students or people who were on low income. And £200 is a lot of money. Like, some of them couldn't eat for a week. Some of them, you know, that was their rent money. You know, luckily, you know, I didn't take it, but a lot of people offered me £200. I got checks in the mail, which was really like, thank you. But, you know, I decided to pay it on my own and I struggled with it. But, you know, it's just something that I chose to do. But that was only because I was in the public eye, you know, and we had to, a lot of people were sort of like helping each other. And all of the sort of people that were fined were like, some of them called me and they were like, what did you do? Have you, do you know anyone who could help me out? And I was trying to like send money to them or try and redirect them to people. And, you know, and it's like Boris Johnson, he probably just got 50 quid. Yeah, just send it over. You know what I mean? And it's, yeah, you know,
it's nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the, I really hope that this conversation and everything else we're seeing on the news actually really shines a light on how corrupt everything is. And you know, just as you said, like, this is not just a stain on your own personal life, but actually it causes so many mental health issues as well. The anxiety that you have, oh, I need to apply for a job. What if someone sees this? And that burden that you have, you know, that massive cloud hanging over your head, not knowing what that could lead to. But Patty, I know that in the last year you've done countless of interviews, countless number of appearances. And I know that it's not easy. I know that it takes a toll physically and mentally as well. But obviously you're doing this because you know that ultimately you know what your purpose is and you know what your end goal is. What's it been like to take care of your mental health, know when to switch off from the internet, and also just keep in mind what your goal is at the end of the day?
It is incredibly hard. I remember when it first happened and I had to do these interviews. I did 3 interviews and they were all live the day after the vigil. And, you know, I went up to London and I was on my own. You know, my family lives back in Essex, so I live on my own with my dog. I'm lucky I have my dog because she's like my little lifesaver. But I, you know, I couldn't see my friends because of coronavirus. And so I was completely on my own. And it was really bad. And, you know, then I got loads of death threats. And the death threats were like, I remember noticing them once because they all went into my request folder. So I clicked on my request once and I was like, there's a lot in here. And I started scrolling. I was like, oh my God, they're all like in-depth death threats of what they do to me, how they do it, where they do it, all of these different things. And I remember I read every single one. And I read every single comment on Twitter and all just all the hate. Because when you're in that position, you want to know what someone is saying about you. And, you know, I've been cyberbullied before. When I was younger, I was bullied quite a lot. But this was on a new level of like people that didn't even know me. And I remember the worst point of it, because my mental health did deteriorate quite a lot. And the worst point, like the lowest point, was when I went onto a live on Instagram, because someone had said, oh, we've seen you at a protest, are you an actress? And I was like, no, I'm not, I'll come on live and prove it. So I went on the live and they were...
Wait, so there were some things going around saying that you'd put up an act at the vigil?
Yeah, or there was, like, if you YouTube it, there's like whole conspiracy theories about me saying that I'm a crisis actress, that I faked it all, that there's just all sorts out there. It's crazy. But there's so much. And because I went to acting school when I was a child and when I was like a teenager, because I wanted to be an actress when I was younger, can't do that now, because if I do become an actress, everyone will be like, see, she's an actress. So great. So I went onto this live and I thought, I'm going to prove that I'm not an actress. And I had a conversation with them. And the main guy started off nice, but I quickly realized they were anti-vaxxers. So they were anti-vaxxers. They were very conspiracy theorists, very like, you know, pro-Trump, some of them. And it was horrible. And then they started calling me names, said you're a scummy snake and this and that and all of these different things. And I just sat there and started crying on this live because I just couldn't believe. I was like, I don't know what to do to prove it. And they were like, well, you're just a liar. You're this, you're that. And I came off the live and I watched. And as I watched, the comments rolling in and there were thousands of people watching and these people were saying really nasty things. And they said, oh, she's still watching. She's still watching. I hope she knows she's this, she's that. And I was just like, oh my God. I turned it off. And I've never felt, you know, it was just a weird feeling. And I just felt so low. I couldn't even get up to my bed. I just laid on the sofa and cried myself to sleep. And that was, to be honest, like, I don't think I've ever said it before, but I was like contemplating ending my life. And that was like, it was a really like bad time, really, really bad time. But I think, you know, slowly with the power of just like understanding trolls, understanding where the hate comes from, you know, talking to people, trying to get a support network, and just trying to do good. You know, I've slowly come out the other end where now if I get trolled, I make a bit of a joke out of it, or I tell them to go and have a cup of tea and calm down because they've obviously got some angry issues against me for no reason. But, you know, it is tough going through things like that. And I can't imagine people that go through that sort of thing, you know, like it, to go viral and that sort of thing happen. And it's out of your control. These people know who you are. You know, and they, you know, I had to move house because of it, because like I reported one of the death threats because there were so many, but I reported one, the worst one, and it's still not been, nothing's happened from it, and this was a year ago. But I remember the police officer came round and gave me a barricade for my door and like things to put on my windows and alarms and stuff, and I just thought, is this just my life now? Like, and it was really, really weird to deal with. But, you know, it's a long process. And I think knowing where to reach out and just knowing that those people don't know who you are. Like, they've just seen a picture and they think they can say whatever they like to you.
I'm really sorry you had to go through that, Patsy. I actually wasn't aware of that side of your story. And I'm really sorry you had to go through that. And I hope things calm down. But I also feel, Patsy, that when you're creating change or when you're in the public eye, when you're in the media and you have the platform that you have, it's part of the parcel. And initially, it's really, really hard to deal with. You think that everyone's against you. And you think like, why? Why would you be against something when I'm trying to, you know, do good? But I just think that's part of the process. It's like your rite of passage. It's for everybody to get to the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange because, I mean, you wouldn't have heard about that side of my story because I haven't said that before. So that's a little, you know, bit that will probably, you know, get some people commenting on something. But, you know,
it's okay. Let the trolls come to me. That's all right. I'll deal with them.
But I think, yeah, like you said, it is a bit of a rite of passage. It's strange. But I think, you know, online hate is such a huge issue at the moment. I think, you know, hate is one thing, but I think the absolute magnitude of it was so much. Especially in a time with coronavirus, so I had no one to reach out to because no one was around. It was just, and I already have mental health issues, so it's just sort of one thing stacked on top of the other. Whereas usually, you know, it would probably be a lot of hate and maybe some death threats and things like that, but you could maybe turn to one person or even to have someone there just to hug you, you know, but I didn't have that. So it was a very isolated sort of time. But yeah, I think I have a very different view of trolls now. I very much look at them as in like, I just assume they're sort of in their parents' basement. You basement. Know, they're just yeah. like, they don't know what they're doing. Even yeah. the turfs, I'm like, you know, I know you hate me, but take a ticket. Do you know what I mean? Like, so does yeah. I don't really care.
No, that's great, Patsy. And it's really nice to see as well that you have this this change of attitude as well, from where you were on your sofa with your phone, just, you know, crying to now sort of laughing at it, because that's all you can do, really. Patsy, this has been like such a fascinating conversation, because now I've been able to put a story to the face. And it's really important, I think, that, you know, when you see people in the media, when you just see that one photo, it's really important to go into a bit of depth and understand why they did what they did. And it adds more of an emotional connection, because in the world of social media, we just don't have that, because you move on from one photo to the next and you forget. And this is why I really enjoy bringing people on the podcast, because it adds so much depth to your story, adds so much power as well. So thank you for everything that you do, Patsy, and thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. Like, your podcast is amazing. So
thank you, Patsy. And if people want to get in touch with you, because I know you might have a podcast coming up soon, or as you said, you're really opening up your platform to help other people. What's the best way to get in touch with you?
So I do have my agent's email on my Twitter, but if you want to get hold of me directly, even if you just want to chat, because, you know, I do have a really nice community of people on Twitter, but my DMs are always open on Twitter. But any like sort of collaborations or work stuff go through my agent. If they're not replying, just message me on Twitter. Yeah.
That's what I did, Patsy. Went straight to you. But thank you so much, Patsy. I can't wait to put this out to the world, and I'm sure you're going to have many more admirers and definitely fewer trolls in the coming months.
Thank you.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in again this week. And if you are on iTunes, please do leave a review and share this with your family and friends. I know that these stories are so inspiring and so powerful as well. Please share this around. It would really mean a lot. I hope you have a lovely week ahead, and I'll see you all next Friday.